everyone who's joined us. Thank you very much for your interest, and welcome to another episode of The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's weekly podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Mike Eckel, filling in for our regular host, Steve Gutterman. My guest today is Nigel Gould-Davies, a senior fellow on Russia and Eurasia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He is also a former ambassador to Belarus and the former head of the economic department at the British Embassy in Moscow, and an all-around very nice guy. Hi, Nigel. Welcome.
Hi, Mike. It's very good to hear you again and take part in your podcast.
We appreciate having you and your insights and your expertise on the podcast. So let's dive right in. The burning question for many, most, all people who are watching all things Russia these days, what's going on in Ukraine? I mean, unbelievable what has happened over the past week. Here we are, nearly seven months into the invasion, since the invasion was launched, and Ukraine appears to have recorded some of the most stunning battlefield successes since the invasion was launched in the Kharkiv region. And we're still piecing together exactly what happened on the battlefield. We did get some corroboration over the weekend from the Russian Defense Ministry, which finally acknowledged the situation and announced a quote-unquote regrouping of its forces toward other occupied Russian territories in the Donbass. The Ukrainians appear to be pushing forward, and they appear to have taken full control of the entire Kharkiv region. So the question, Nigel, is what do you make of all this? Are we at a major inflection point for the war?
Yeah, I would say that's no exaggeration. This does feel like a turning point, perhaps as significant as Russia's initial failure in late February and early March to take Kyiv. And I think it tells us several things. Firstly, well, my view has always been that the outbreak of the war itself was no surprise and to be expected. But the course of the war since then has been very unpredictable. I always thought that the attrition narrative, that this settled down into a long, slow, grinding stalemate that will last for months, had always been somewhat oversold. And it was worth looking at the tail risks, whether the situation on the battlefield could shift dramatically in favor of one side or the other. That's what seems to have happened, at least on one major front. And we're looking closely also, of course, at the operation that's going on in Kherson. But I think what's already clear is that several consequences follow from the advances of the past few days. And we're talking about in the order of maybe 5,000 to 8,000 square kilometers liberated. It's extraordinary. The first is that Ukraine has not only, as it has throughout this war, outfought Russia, it's also outthought it. And I mean, all the signs are at this stage that this was, among other things, a strategic deception of epic proportions. There had been a long Soviet tradition of strategic deception in the way they thought about the use of armed forces and indeed other instruments of foreign policy. That seems to be entirely absent from the Russian side of things. We have the opposite of strategic deception and the long, slow, very obvious and public build-up to the war itself. But here you've had something very well thought through for weeks and weeks. President Zelensky himself, as well as other senior Ukrainian figures, have been talking about Kherson, 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 and that seems to have fooled Russia, and that's why it moved a significant proportion of its best forces down there. And what happens? Yes, again, there's a Kherson operation, but at this stage, what's far more significant is what is happening around Kharkiv. So the Russians were quite comprehensively deceived, it seems to me. And that's part of a larger ongoing revelation about the quality of leadership and generalship on the Ukrainian side, in sharp contrast to, as political as well as military, in contrast to Russia. The second is that the military significance of this is at least matched by the political significance. Ukraine is not only taking territory, it's sending a very clear signal, both to itself and its own population, its own troops, that it really can make very significant gains. And that, I think, was important for morale after some of the quite significant losses that Ukraine suffered a month or two ago. It shows the West, look, stop this nonsense talk about compromises on partitions. We are the stronger party here, and the weapons you are providing us with are making a real substantive difference. We can learn how to use them very quickly and use them very effectively. So more of that, please. And thirdly, most important, perhaps, to Russia, it is sending a signal, you cannot win this war. And that is, you've mentioned the Russian Ministry of Defense statement earlier. It was slow and fairly minimalist, but that is just part of a much larger story. Perhaps we can delve into a little bit later about the domestic consequences and the disarray that this has thrown Russia and Russian commentators and the Russian media into. But just to sort of sew all this together, we have now a situation where there is obviously a clear and unbridgeable gap between Russia's aspirations and its capabilities. The status quo for Russia is unsustainable. See, Russia has a choice now, and it's a sharper choice than it's faced at any time since this war. What does it do? Does it try to increase its capabilities, or does it try to draw back its aspirations and intentions? And that's the question ultimately that Putin has to answer now. His assumption up to this point, and he said it many times in different forms, ultimately is that time is on Russia's side, the time that Russia is just big enough and tough enough and resilient to grind out victory, both against Ukraine on the battlefield and against the West on the economic front. And now for the first time, it is becoming unmistakably clear that time is no longer on Russia's side.
Today, in fact, we had a Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, chiming in. He was asked pointedly by reporters about basically the conduct of the war, or the special military operation, excuse me, that's how it's called within Russia. And he made a kind of, you know, anodyne statement, you know, the war, the operation will continue until the goals that we've set out are achieved. Doesn't really tell you a whole lot. And that's part of the, of course, age-old problem with trying to figure out what's going on in the Kremlin. The black box can't figure out who's deciding, who's counseling, who's providing the most accurate assessments to Putin himself. So, you know, let's take that cue and shift to domestic politics. And what will the fallout, do you think, of these battlefield successes or failures be in Moscow? The Kremlin, of course, has refused to go full bore and call for a general mobilization, despite overwhelming evidence that there are serious manpower issues with Russian military personnel in the field. Has time run out for the Kremlin in this regard? And what about the fallout for Putin's inner circle? You know, there are just a few hawks that are really have Putin's ear on this matter, like Bortnikov and Bastrykin and Patrushev and Shoigu, those characters. What do you think is going to happen domestically inside the Kremlin? Give us your best read.
Yeah, there's palpable unease, and we've seen even on television. There's also on Twitter. You may have seen the excerpts from the NTV talk
yes.
show. And I think just the other. And this is astonishing. This is open disagreement. You have people there on television saying that this war is unwinnable, and one asking another there, look, you have a 10-year-old son, do you want him to grow up and be ready to fight in this war, and so on. That's it testifies to the disarray. There is no, the Kremlin no longer has, and therefore can no longer to the state media, direct a clear narrative about how to think about this. And again, it's this divergence between capabilities and intentions and goals. Even the secondary interim goal that has set itself of annexing Luhansk and Donetsk and all set up to fake the referenda on that, that's completely out of the window now. So how do they define their objectives ahead. And you talk about the option of mobilization. That, of course, would try to bridge the gap by increasing capabilities. But that is the bridge that I think, above all, Putin is reluctant to cross, because he knows that that would be the moment of truth in respect of testing the real extent of Russian support for this. Let's call it a war, because that's what it is. It's easy to shout support from the sofa when you're watching television, and you'll tell a stranger who asks your opinion in an opinion poll that you support the war. Of course you would. You run risks in saying anything otherwise. But already the polls, more pointed and specific questions that are asked, draw attention to some of the doubts. If people are asked, do you want the war to continue, then support falls very significantly. If you ask them whether they or anyone close to them would be willing to fight, then already that's a minority. That's an extraordinary result in people willing to tell pollsters that, despite the risks of doing so, despite the fact that state propaganda is pumping out very different messages all the time. But if the Kremlin tells its citizens, you have to fight, you have no choice, and your husband does, and your sons do, then I think that would be the straw that finally breaks the back of public support. And that's why they don't want to cross it. And even in the best case, that wouldn't be a solution available to Russia for months and months. It's not as if the order of mobilization is suddenly tripping a switch and you have these kind of serried ranks of orcs kind of spring up from the ground. It takes months and months, months, or even rudimentary training. And here's one more point of comparison. So, of course, Ukrainians are fighting for their territory. Their morale and motivation are very, very high. The morale and motivation of Russian conscripts will be low. The morale and ability and effectiveness, even of the citizens in Luhansk and Donetsk, the occupied, Russian-occupied regions that Russia has pressed into service, they are miserable. They hate this war. They are protesting against being forced to fight, even on their own territory. So how would it be for Russia?
So if I were to put you on the spot and say, will there be mobilization or not? It sounds like you would say you don't think they have the stomach to go in that direction. Would that be correct?
It would be a last resort, really. I mean, there is a stealth mobilization. There are kind of semi-mobilization-like measures taking place, both in the economy and respect of infantry as well. And you've got people being pulled out of prisons, for example. I'm not saying it won't happen. I'm saying if it does happen, then it poses significant new domestic challenges for this regime. But just more widely on your question about elite opinion, what's going on in the Kremlin, watch some of the other voices, some of the things that Ramzan Kadyrov has been saying recently, openly expressing his dissatisfaction with the way that the war has gone. Watch for voices like that. I suspect there'll be more and more of them if this situation continues to deteriorate. There is the signs of a kind of a general degeneration going on in parts of the Russian elite. It's very strange. You'll recall Maria Zakharova's dangling strawberries, for example, and Vladimir Solovyov kind of bruised face. So I've got a piece of this in the next issue of our journal, Survival. There is a kind of fin de regime, moral degeneration taking place. It's something to watch.
So let's take that cue and go a little bit deeper into Russian domestic politics to another event that occurred over this weekend that may have been overlooked by a lot of people on the outside. There were elections in Russia this weekend, actually from Friday until Sunday. On the regional level, in about 14 or 15 Russian regions, there were gubernatorial elections. There were legislative elections in another handful of regions. In Moscow, on the district level, we're talking the hyper-local councils that oversee things like painting playground equipment and cleaning up trash or planting trees. On that level, there were elections held this weekend. I mean, do elections matter anymore in Russia? I mean, the country, the Kremlin has sort of been slipping away from any pretense of a kind of free and fair democratic competitive system of choosing its leaders for some years now. And now here we are. This is the first set of elections to be held since the invasion. Do they matter anymore? Should we ignore them? Should we still pay attention to them?
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. Most authoritarian regimes hold things called elections, and they continue to hold them. They don't stop holding them. And there's a kind of large literature about why they do this, if they're not free and fair. And there are a series of sort of standard answers that are made to that. They're kind of safety valves. You know, very occasionally some low-level functionary will be removed or be allowed to be removed by an election if they're very unpopular. Or it's an opportunity to mobilize a public support, public sort of performative affirmation from below. That was basically the Soviet situation where you had 99% turnouts and so on. It was a holiday. You got free food from the buffet and all of that. It was a kind of a coming together to solidify support, not express views. Or a way of sort of taking the temperature of the population. Now, the question for Russia, in Russia now, is whether the elections have become so thoroughly unfree that they are genuinely meaningless and can't really perform any of these even more limited functions that elections, things called elections, serve in normal times in authoritarian systems. There's essentially no independent media, no real opposition candidates. There are, of course, some brave independent candidates that are able to run, plenty that are struck off for this or that pretext. There's the addition of online voting, which is, of course, a very opaque way of falsifying elections. And then even when people are elected, they can then be removed and arrested, like Sergei Fergal, the Khabarovsk governor, a couple of years ago. So the outcomes don't matter, but I think they matter in a couple of other respects. One is that it's still the only even quasi opposition activity that is in principle allowed. So people are technically able to go around, canvass, knock on doors and say, we are not the United Russia candidate. They are still formally able to do that. So that creates a kind of a tiny space for difference. And therefore, it technically sort of keeps the reflexes of opposition alive, however embattled or beleaguered they are. So as it were, they are kind of an investment in the future as far as those who are able to sort of take part in them but don't bow their heads to the regime. So in terms of process and activity rather than outcomes, I think that's the way to look at it. There are a couple of specific results that I was looking for. So in Udmurtia, Alexander Brchalov fought off the Communist Party challenge there. He's come to be re-elected. And then in Buryatia, of course, which has been a supplier of a large number of forces that have fought in Ukraine, and the hints of local discontent there, the United Russian candidate Alexei Sidyenov has been re-elected with over 80% of the vote. So if there were any oppositional discontent there, it wasn't allowed to express itself.
Of course, the big next election that we'll all be watching for is the presidential election set for 2024, when we will by then hopefully have some sense of whether President Putin intends to stay on for another term or in some sort of supra capacity. So it's a little early to be, you know, placing your markers on what's going to happen. But I think it's safe to say that the next year and a half are going to be very, 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 very interesting domestically within Russia.
Yeah. 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 Can I just add to that quickly? So, yeah, that's two years ahead. Look what happened 2 years ago in Belarus. So again, elections are always, at least formally speaking, opportunities for alternatives to present themselves and for a process, an appearance of contestation to take place. For that reason, they are surprisingly often stressed points to some degree. You recall Bologna process protests and so on in 2011, 2012. But look what happened in Belarus, not just in Minsk, but across the country, almost exactly 2 years ago. That was an explosion of a kind which Lukashenko himself did not foresee, and the consequences have been very, very significant. Russia, of course, helped save Lukashenko by the support it gave, but was taking notes as it did so, because it knew that this served as a potential precedent for its own management of its election in 2024. So it knows this. And before this war broke out, the lengthening shadow of 2024 was being cast across every aspect of the Russian political landscape. So yes, everyone is preparing for it. They know that that could be a mobilizer. If things get very bad now, now you've got the losing war, now you've got the sanctions, which I predict will be far more severe in their effects by then. That is creating a kind of cauldron, and I think the Kremlin knows
a it. Cauldron. So on that note, let's take a few questions from listeners in the time we have remaining. If you listeners would like to ask a question, you can hit the button in Twitter Spaces to request to speak. You can also send a direct message by Twitter, or you can also post your question as a reply to the tweet pinned in this Twitter space. So if anyone has a question, please go ahead. And there may not be any questions. There is one question. One second.
If there's not, Mike, can I just add one more thing?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so just on elections. So, again, as you know, in Soviet times, there were elections. There was only ever one candidate for each position. The only other option was voting against all, protiv всех. And very, very occasionally, against all would win the election. And this was a kind of example of the kind of extremist safety valve, truly unpopular, just useless wretches could be kicked out and the system would allow it. And one of the more fascinating and heroic bits of research on the Soviet Union during Soviet times was, I remember a chap called Jerome Gillison wrote an article in 1968, and he entitled The Missing 1%. So he actually looked at all of the election results where against all won, and drew some very interesting conclusions about the circumstances in which against all would be allowed to win. It's just a fascinating, for the more scholarly minded of our listeners, a fascinating
research. That's totally fascinating. I had no idea that was someone had done that research. And turns out we do have a question from a gentleman named Chris. Chris, let's get you able to ask your question, please.
Yeah, sure. Hi, Mike, Nigel. I know that the Russian media is, pretty biased and more like a cheer squad for Russia than any kind of independent media. I'm just wondering, are they letting on about the numbers of Russian soldiers that are dead, and how are the Russian people reacting to this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I looked into this a month or two ago because, as you know, not only Ukraine, but various Western sources are regularly providing their assessments about the numbers of Russian troops who have been killed or wounded. So I was checking what Russia itself has said about this. And at that time, the last official number I could come up with, issued by the Russian Ministry of Defense, was sometime in late mid or late March, And of course, even then, it was absurdly low. I think they were saying maybe less than 2,000, something like that. And as of, I think, around July, they had not issued an update. They may have done so more recently. If so, I haven't seen it. I rather suspect that they haven't. So, no, that's not the sort of figures. Even they're not even giving falsified figures. I mean, that's quite interesting. There have, of course, been particularly in the local media, commemorations of the markings of the funerals of those soldiers who have been killed and then sort of brought back. And some independent journalists have done some, usually from abroad, have tried to sort of count these up and offer their own assessments. But officially, no. This is not a regime that's minded to tell its people the truth in general, frankly. And if it's a matter of telling them the truth about the number of people that have died as a consequence of unnecessary aggressive war. No, I don't think we should expect that anytime soon.
Nigel, if I recall correctly, I think the number was 1,351 was the official tally as of the end of March.
Brilliant memory, Mike.
I write about the casualty figures all the time because, like you, like everybody, you know, it's a war and you want to know, you know, the bodies and killed in action, wounded in action, prisoners of war and whatnot. And it's really fascinating because we get estimates fairly routinely out of the West, from the Americans, from the Brits, even from the Germans. We get official estimates. In fact, I think the British defense minister just last week or 2 weeks ago, Mr. Ben Wallace, offered up a figure of, I think, 25,000 Russian soldiers killed in action and maybe 80,000 or thereabouts total casualties for the Russian armed forces. You know, and that's an estimate. That's an estimate based on Western intelligence. But, you know, to your point, Chris, within Russia, there's no discussion about this. Not at all. You can probably find it looking on Telegram channels if you're really digging hard. There are some brave Russian journalists from Media Zona, and I believe Medusa as well, who have tried to come up with some semblance of a minimum figure of casualties, but they're not talking about it. They're not allowed to talk about it within Russia, and I think that's reflected in the overall Russian society's lackadaisical, you know, we don't really know what's going on in Ukraine attitude. Nigel, you want to say something more on that?
I think you're better placed to answer it than me, Mike. Excellent response.
Fair enough. Any more questions for our listeners? Feel free to raise your hand or send us a direct message or send or post your reply to the Twitter thread. If not,
yes, I'm just wondering: are people in Russia skeptical about these numbers, or are they just completely oblivious to them, or is it that they kind of get a sense that they're not being told the truth, but they just don't really want to know about it? I'm not sure. I can't get a sense of that.
Nigel, you want to feel that?
It's without. Without being in Russia and having those conversations in the kitchen, in which these things might be privately shared, it's hard to get a very clear fix on this. And there is a long tradition of Russians who cultivated in Soviet times as a public and private lives. And there are only certain circumstances in which you acknowledge doubts and close confidants you share. A different view from the official one with. There are of course people who have been directly affected. Just the losses are not just theoretical to them. They've lost family members or they've known friends and so on that have lost their lives. And there are at least in some cases. They were sort of curated for state TV propaganda examples where they've said, well, actually, this person, you know, my son or whatever, has given his life, and therefore we must do more to sort of justify this loss. And Mike, I mean, you follow the media on this. You'll recall, for example, the grotesque spectacle of someone being given a larder or something.
Yes, that's right there.
Compensation for the death of their child. But I would say in Russia, as in elsewhere, but particularly in Russia, perhaps at the moment, the psychology of these things is very complicated, and there are kind of elements of denial and suppression, rather than a clear and fixed view. But denial and suppression are not stable. They are not stable elements, as it were. They can, when the circumstances change, this comes back to the larger question you sort of touched on earlier, Mike, about the response of the larger impact of this war on Russia and Russian society as well, actually, as well as elites in the state. These are things that could rush out potentially.
Yes.
We've seen that sort of thing before. So there's not allowed to be an overt discourse at the moment about the scale of the losses and what that means. But I think that forces are being stored up, put it that way, psychologically and kind of quasi-politically, that will sooner or later, one day, be released in some form.
One other thought on that same point is, of course, within military units themselves, you know, in military towns, whereby a base makes up the heart of a town or a community, these discussions are going on. They're very much going on. My Russian colleagues did a fascinating investigation last month that looked at a unit called the 64th Separate Guards Motor Rifle Brigade, based in the far eastern region of Khabarovsk, where there's a wall of honor for the soldiers who have died in the fight. And the unit has suffered an extraordinarily high rate of casualties in the war. And, you know, it's an open secret. Everybody knows this is happening. Everybody knows the soldiers are dying. So the discussions are happening. And I think, as you said, Nigel, they may be kitchen table discussions. But, you know, and it might be building up to the point where we'll see more and more of this in the media. But for the moment, you're not going to see it on state TV. You're not going to see it in the newspapers or in major publications. We have another question from a read.
Yeah, sorry, just.
Yes, please.
As you know, Mike, in the last week or two, we've I think, seen these two examples of disillusioned combatants publishing their diaries.
Yes.
And I think that's very significant.
We have a question from a listener named Anna Reed. Anna, you want to go ahead, please?
Sure. Can you hear
yes.
me?
Yes. Go right ahead.
First, I want to thank Radio Freedom for one of the few bright spots in the Twitter universe, or maybe the whole media. You guys are doing an excellent, excellent job at staying away from our polarizing politics and going to the facts. So thank you for that. And second, I just wanted to say that I'm monitoring a lot of Russian nationalistic social accounts on Telegram and Twitter and so, and you can see great discontent in regards to Russia. And I'm just curious if you are seeing the same thing. Thank you.
I guess, yeah. So the question sounds like it's about maybe nationalists or hardcore patriots.
Aladugin. Uh-huh. The account similar to Gadugin and that type of account.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nigel,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, again, you'll have much to say, Mike. But yes, there is a kind of a military and nationalist commentariat which is dismayed not by the scale of the losses that, how to put it, not by the scale of losses that Russia has suffered, but the fact that they haven't inflicted more losses on Ukraine, as it were. They want to escalate the war, and they're appalled by this latest debacle because they are accusing their own leadership of incompetence. This hasn't sown doubt into their minds about the wisdom or justice of the war. They want to go further. That's absolutely right. They are vocal. They're sort of allowed, as it were, to express those thoughts, so they occupy a part of the social media space. For for uh, for that reason, there are some who say, well, we should worry about what might happen after Putin. It could be someone even worse who comes to power. Now, entering very, very obviously speculative territory here, I'm not so sure. And again, against the background of what's been a very, very unpredictable course of events, I will make the prediction that if, for whatever reason, Putin were to leave the scene for political or physical reasons, I think the war would end quite quickly.
Hmm.
The reason I think that is that I believe most of the elites, not all, but and we can name the individuals, and you mentioned some of them earlier, Mike, who are you know, part of the hardest of the hard men who are all in on this, but I think they're the exceptions. I think most of the elites are quietly very, very unhappy and have been from the start, even before the start of this war. Recall the anxious, the palpable anxiety at that surreal improv theater of the absurd that was the Security Council meeting on February the 21st. So, and the elites are by definition the best informed. They are best placed to take a clear view about how in the round this war and all its consequences, sanctions and so on, are shaping Russia's future. And I think there is an implicit, broad, not complete, broad consensus that they want this to end. The rough analogy I'd make is with the death of Stalin in March 1953. And within weeks of his death, his successors, who disagreed with one another vigorously on many other matters, and of course you had the big showdown of the anti-party group in 1957 and all that, but within weeks of Stalin's death, they'd begun to step away from this combination of extreme domestic pressure, repression, and extreme international tension that Stalin had led the country into. And if you're comparing war with war, within a few months, the Korean War, which had been raging for 3 years, came to an end. And I think this war would resemble that one. And this a post-Putin situation now would, in those respects, analogically represent the kind of direction of travel we'd see after that.
That's an amazing comparison to contemplate. And boy, anything is possible these days. There are two more questions that have popped up. They're more battlefield questions. And one was a question about whether the Ukrainian armed forces can keep up with their counteroffensive. And another question is a speculation that Russia may get to the point that that it's desperate, that the Kremlin may decide to use non-conventional weapons. Tactical nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, something awful like that. Nigel, what do you think about either of those questions?
Yeah, the first one is, as it were, an operational military one, and that's not my domain. I'll make the obvious point that others have made, that it's important not to get, and the Ukrainians understand this very well, not to get carried away by as it were, euphoria, or to go too far, and still don't levels of rottenness have been revealed about every aspect of this Russian operation and its leadership and its capabilities, its morale. Still, don't underestimate them. So you need to, you know, do the good military things, like not overextend your supply lines and spread yourselves too thin, and all of that. On the broader question, yes, and this comes back to this fundamental point that I was making early on, this unbridgeable gap in the status quo between capabilities and intentions. Does Russia now scale back its goals and try to define some minimally acceptable outcome and impose or negotiate on that? I think Ukraine is less minded than ever to negotiate an end that would leave any square inch of Ukrainian territory in Russian hands? Or, alternatively, does Russia try to escalate, to increase its capabilities or its use of them in some way it hasn't before? We talked about mobilization earlier. That will put, I think, real strains on the body politic. The alternative is a different kind of escalation into new forms of weapons. So, and this is the prospect that has always most alarmed the West, of course. So, chemical or even nuclear weapons. And again, we're entering very speculative territory when we do this. So I'll just, you know, offer a couple of thoughts. One is that, of course, although Putin almost explicitly warned about this in his speech declaring the so-called special military operation on 24th of February, in practice, if you look at the course of the past more than, well, 200 days now, it's the West and Ukraine that have escalated much more than Russia.
Mm-hmm.
West in its supply of sophisticated forms of weapons, Ukraine in the scale of its operations and the audacity of its attacks on Russian soil itself, also on occupied Crimea. So and Russia hasn't really responded to those with escalating its own. So, but the future can be different from the past. And again, the choices Russia faces now are more difficult than at any point. So, if it is going to, as it were, cross that threshold, break that, say, nuclear taboo, then it's more likely to do that now than before. But the consequences, even though the consequences will be very, very severe for Russia itself, and it must know that. And then what would be the scenario, the political scenario? What purpose would that serve exactly? So Russia now, it seems to me, it cannot under any circumstances defeat Ukraine. It can only try to destroy. It's already hinted at that with these can't describe them as kind of revenge attacks on the power infrastructure that we've yes. seen in the past day or so, and what also it's done to the Zaporizhia nuclear power, the electricity supply yes. There. So that's just pure hurt, as it were. It doesn't make Ukraine fight less effectively. So could it be something like that? Pure, you know, I can't defeat you, so I'll destroy you. Again, we're in genuinely uncharted territory. I still think for various reasons the probability of that is low, but it's a little higher now than it was.
Well, with that, Nigel, let's call it a wrap. Thank you so much for joining me. Totally fascinating discussion and some things to think about, some very, very things to think about. Thank you for joining us once again.
Absolute pleasure.
Once again, folks, I've been talking with Nigel Gould-Davies, former British ambassador and senior Russia and Eurasian fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. I'm Mike Eckel, filling in for Steve Gutterman. One last reminder, this live conversation will be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and all of RFERL's podcasts via Apple, Spotify, Google, wherever you listen to your podcast. Next week, there will be no podcast. So join us the following week on September 26th when Steve Gutterman will be back in the seat. Thanks again for joining us.